Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. California Governor Gavin Newsom says he plans to further scale back reopening plans as a new surge in coronavirus cases continues up and down the state. The rate of community spread has been on the rise for the past 2 weeks. So have hospitalizations.
And one of the latest clusters is at San Quentin State Prison in the San Francisco Bay Area. So let's bring in Dr. Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo, chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Bibbins-Domingo, at San Quentin, at least one in four inmates now has COVID-19 after some inmates were moved from another prison. What happened?
Yeah, prisons are a known challenge during the pandemic because of the close living settings. And we've had prison outbreaks of coronavirus infections in the prisons in Southern California. 121 prisoners were transferred during a prison outbreak. The thought had been that they had been tested, but apparently hadn't been tested within several weeks before being transferred up to San Quentin. And when they arrived and were introduced to the population in San Quentin, it turns out that several were infected. So even though San Quentin had no infections, this prisoner transfer appears to have seeded infections there. And the prison is already well above capacity. And so this close environment, unable to really isolate and quarantine people, dormitory style of housing prisoners in San Quentin, and then the introduction of new cases, has really created a really devastating situation in San Quentin.
Terrible. Those transferred prisoners came from the California Institution for Men in Chino. 9 inmates had died there. Nearly 700 had been infected. The thinking was that it would reduce the number of infections at that prison. But of course, it launched so many more at San Quentin. And one of your colleagues writes, as you've indicated, this particular prison, San Quentin, is built in 1852. It's the same as Alcatraz, same year as Alcatraz. It's 170% of its capacity. It seems like prisons across the country could take a look at this and see it as a cautionary tale.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the additional issues of the very poor ventilation in this particular prison, the overcapacity, the inability to really isolate and quarantine. And then we've had the additional issues that we have a long turnaround time to test results in California in the prison system, and 6 days to find that a test result is positive makes it virtually impossible. And it's important to note that prisoners have been infected, some have died, as well as the people who work in the prison at San Quentin. And so this is a challenge across the state, a current challenge for us here in the Bay Area, and really one that we need to plan for, because these are known problems during a time of a pandemic like this.
Well, yeah, you talk about people working in the prison. They, of course, are going home to their communities. Yesterday, we talked about the rising cases in Los Angeles County, but widen the lens there in Northern California, some less populated areas there. What's the situation?
Yeah, I think many can think of prisons that these are happening in very isolated situations. But as you say, people who work in prisons then bring the infections out. In fact, we also have to think that people who live in an area also bring infections in. And so prisons, even though they are closed off from the community, are really part and parcel of the community. We're seeing surges across California. We've had generally low rates across California, but as we've reopened, we have seen a resurgence of cases across the state. And I think the combination of us just having more community spread, plus these outbreaks and pockets of a high density of infections in prisons, in meat packing plants, and in some of our Latinx and other poor and minority communities, that even in counties where the spread has been well controlled, have had outbreaks in these particular communities. All of those together have meant the state is really dealing with an upsurge of cases right now.
Yeah. Well, and we have the 4th of July weekend coming. What's your advice to families in Northern California?
Well, one of the biggest things that we know that has led to these outbreaks is just our natural inclination after being sheltered for so long to want to see the people we want to spend time with, our friends, our families, our loved ones. And we know that some of the smaller outbreaks that have happened have been just with families coming together in a house, or young people gathering together in bars. Really, we have to be cautious at this time. Everyone needs to wear a mask. We want to get together with people, but we have to do it in a safe way. That is, in a smaller numbers of people, people we know well. And outdoors are much safer than indoors. And in all cases, we want to understand how to get together and be in contact with people, but in the safest way possible, because we want to keep our families and friends safe, just as we want to have a good time over the holiday weekend.
Create family masks. Dr. Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo, chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco. Professor Dr. Bibbins-Domingo, thank you.
Thank you.
To Hong Kong now. Police fired water cannons and pepper spray at protesters during demonstrations against a new security law imposed on Hong Kong by China's communist government. Earlier today, I spoke with CNN international correspondent Will Ripley on Skype. He'd been reporting on the streets, and I asked him about the new law and how the police were using it against the protesters.
Peter, I was really surprised to see so many police out on the streets. Last year, on July 1st, there was a massive demonstration. You couldn't even move in the streets of Causeway Bay as they marched towards the Legislative Council. And then we know they broke into that building. They occupied the building. It was shocking. It was a turning point. They were spray painting anti-China slogans on the walls. And the police stayed back. It was, you were almost wondering why they allowed this kind of thing to go on for so long. Fast forward 1 year later, you have a tiny fraction of the amount of protesters out, and exponentially more officers. They were everywhere, it seemed like, just convoys of police vehicles. And what they did is essentially they were in so many different places all at once that they were able to stop any demonstration before it even bubbled up. But of course, because the national security law is now in effect, far fewer people were willing to take the risk and go out there and demonstrate today.
It sounds like it doesn't even take much now to be arrested. You've reported that a man waving a Hong Kong independence banner was detained by police, and that even things that people are saying or chanting on the street could get you arrested under this new law with severe punishment.
If you are in possession of a flag and they find it in your backpack and it says Hong Kong independence or Taiwan independence, you are arrested and charged under this new national security law. Hong Kong is making the case, you know, even though this law was imposed by Beijing without any input from the Hong Kong government or the people of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, the chief executive, is still making the argument that this is protecting citizens from these dangerous terrorists who are out protesting. I can see their point with setting fires or, you know, trying to, you know, create improvised explosive devices. But how is somebody who has a banner that says Hong Kong independence a threat to national security? That is the question that I intend to ask whoever will let me ask that question. You know, it's hard to get a sit down these days with anybody from the Hong Kong government. Frankly, they didn't even know anything about this bill in terms of details until after it had already passed unanimously. But the number of arrests for the number of people who were out is really striking. We're tape recording this. It's just before 9 o'clock in the evening here, and already Hong Kong police have arrested at least 300 people over the past several hours. I mean, the numbers have just been climbing up, and I bet you by the time this airs on your program, the number of arrests will be even higher.
So it sounds like the police have been emboldened here. I know you also tweeted a photo of a police officer who was stabbed by a protester in the arm. Put that into context for me.
Look, there has been violence against police officers, and it's really unfortunate that it happens. And we saw some shocking videos from the protest last year where officers were drop kicked. I mean, remember, officers were firing off guns with live ammunition because they were surrounded by protesters throwing bricks at them, you know, attacking them. Police officers have definitely felt under threat, but they have been accused repeatedly of disproportionate response towards these protesters. And now they have strength in numbers. You can impose a law, but there's still going to be that anger bubbling. That doesn't go away just because there's a law. And frankly, I wouldn't be shocked to see more attacks against police officers. And frankly, this law could radicalize those who are still convinced that they want to fight. Except now, if they're going to be charged with terrorism anyway, how much further could they go? That's my big concern moving forward. But, you know, the national security law gives unprecedented ability for the police here in Hong Kong, like the authorities in China, to monitor, to conduct raids, to conduct, you know, all sorts of surveillance that never was possible under the law here before. And so we really are in uncharted territory. We're in uncharted legal territory for the people who've been arrested. We don't know if they're going to get slapped with a huge sentence, 10 years for having a sign like that. I mean, the maximum is life imprisonment. This is all unknown. But we know that people can potentially be tried in the mainland in certain cases. And some of these trials might be held away from the public without any press allowed, and just an announcement made at the end about how it went without even a jury, just a panel of three judges.
And just briefly, there has been some international response here. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said it is a sad day for Hong Kong and freedom-loving people across China. What else are you hearing around the world?
Well, the United States is starting the process of stripping away the special relationship that, you know, it has with Hong Kong in terms of trade, because they feel that Hong Kong no longer enjoys a high degree of autonomy from mainland China. You have the United Kingdom offering a path to citizenship for 3 million British nationals overseas, you know, living here in Hong Kong, basically allowing these people, if they want to leave, to more easily move back to the United Kingdom. These are steps that countries are taking because they feel that their citizens might not be safe here any longer, or at least might not be living in the place that they thought they were.
CNN international correspondent Will Ripley has been reporting from the streets of Hong Kong today. Will, thanks as always for your time.
Thanks, Peter.
It's here and now. In a Sacramento, California courtroom Monday, a judge questioned former police officer Joseph James DeAngelo Jr. about the plea he was about to enter.
Do you understand, Mr. DeAngelo, that you'll be entering guilty pleas to 13 counts of murder in the first degree, admitting special circumstances, enhancements, as well as admitting to uncharged acts? Do you understand that, sir?
Yes.
DeAngelo was pleading guilty to being the Golden State Killer, the vicious predator responsible for 13 murders and some 50 rapes and sexual assaults starting in the mid-1970s in California. Because of the pandemic, the hearing was live-streamed. Sadly, Michelle McNamara didn't live to see it. She was the true crime journalist who died 2 years before DeAngelo was caught through DNA evidence, but whose dogged work was key in helping to catch him. As the creator of the popular website TrueCrimeDiary.com, she gathered a huge community of online civilian crime solvers, detectives who took their research seriously, and was writing her riveting study of the Golden State Killer case, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, when she died. But her book is now the basis of an HBO documentary series, which premiered on Sunday and lets us hear her voice.
The great tragedy of this case to me is that it's not better known. I mean, I can't... I wish Zodiac would get rid of his 15 minutes of fame so that Eurons could get a little heat, you know?
Right. Michelle McNamara's husband, comedian Patton Oswalt, is an executive producer of the series. He's worked tirelessly on behalf of his late wife's work. We met up at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline, Massachusetts in 2018 to talk about it. Though as the star of films like Ratatouille and TV shows like The King of Queens, he acknowledged the absurdity of the situation.
There's a drop-off in gravitas when you're talking about this unprecedented true crime journalist and basically crime fighter. And here to talk about her is the other chubby guy from King of Queens.
Patton's love for his late wife is palpable. They had one child, and in the book, she writes about his unique gifts to her. You commissioned artists to paint her facing off against crime figures?
Because the three that she was really obsessed with were the Zodiac, and then D.B. Cooper, and then the Golden State Killers. So it's like a drawing of her facing off against each of them, like I'm going to find them somehow.
Michelle McNamara became obsessed with the man she named the Golden State Killer in 2011, when DNA testing connected perhaps the country's most prolific serial rapist to double murders. She pored over police reports, met victims, had thousands of digital files and an unfinished manuscript when she died in her sleep in 2016 from a combination of drugs prescribed for anxiety and insomnia and an undiagnosed condition. In his grief, Patton corralled her assistants to complete the book. We sat down to talk about it, and a warning, we'll be talking about some brutal crimes, which started in Sacramento. I want to read a little of Michelle's beautiful writing. By May 16th, a surge of newly installed floodlights lit up the east side like a Christmas tree. In one house, tambourines were tied to every door and window. Hammers went under pillows. Nearly 3,000 guns were sold in Sacramento County between January and May. Many people refused to sleep between 1 and 4 a.m. Some couples slept in shifts. One of them always stationed on the living room couch, a rifle pointed at the window. Only a madman would strike again. But of course he did.
I mean, you know, he shook up the idea that a locked door, a bolted window kept you safe, and that can really spread like a virus and an infection through a community. That's the whole point of a community, is people getting together to feel safer. Now suddenly he was directly attacking that idea.
Yeah. She also describes what was happening, and this is, I think, one of her greatest contributions, because you know, we're used to hearing there's a sexual assault, and it's a horrible thing, but you're allowed to make it a statistic and not really think further about what that means. She doesn't let you do that. She gives you the details. The mother who crawls across the floor to a son's toy saw to try to cut her binding. The husbands. And this is very difficult to hear, but this struck you as well.
Yeah, it was the husband was made to lie face down on the floor. He would stack cups and plates on his back. He goes, if I hear any of these hit the floor, I'll kill both of you. It's an attack on the woman. It's an attack on the idea of a man protecting a woman. It's an attack on two people that are, you know, in love and pledged to one another. It's just all every single aspect of security and kind of light that he could attack, he would attack if he was given the chance.
Another image that stayed with me, the neighbor who tells her she's stunned to see a naked man, hand and feet bound, hopping out of the front door of his house. This is her neighbor. And she's like, what? It doesn't compute, but of course he's trying to escape, she realizes.
It was just images like that that would kind of shatter what is supposed to be a place of peace and safety. And suddenly you introduce these almost avant-garde, horrific elements to it. It's very hard to recover from that.
Yeah. Talk about the detectives. Again, here's her writing about them and how for decades some of them worked on this. Decades after retirement, one detective found himself squatting in the woods outside a possible suspect's house in Oregon, waiting for the trash to come out so he could swipe a DNA sample. The Golden State Killer haunts their dreams. He'd ruined their marriages. He's burrowed so deeply inside their heads that they want to, or have to, believe that if they locked eyes with him, they'd know. It's kind of like a bloodhound thing, a detective said to me, and this is Michelle. I believe if I were at a mall and he passed by me, I'd know.
Yeah, we had a big summit dinner for all of them to hopefully get them to maybe share some information.
Yeah, you said that dinner was like a Justice League meeting.
Yeah, that's how it felt. But you know, these are people that their calling in life was to bring justice and right the scales and to go through your life and knowing there's this massive injustice that happened and you weren't able to right those scales can really, really eat away at these guys. And it's heroic how they just keep going back into it.
Yeah. Also, you were just in awe at their skill. Michelle got a thumb drive of a call from the killer. And you guys thought, well, maybe the caller was in a hospital?
Well, we're friends with this musician named Michael Penn, and he knew a guy over at Capitol Records that was really good at doing audio forensics and really got into the background. We thought the guy was calling from a hospital. It turns out he was calling. There was a TV on behind him with a TV movie where there was a scene set in a hospital, and that's what was going on.
And it's an audio expert, one of these detectives, who figures that out. I mean, these people are so good. And yet, he's not found. Talk about the toll this is taking on Michelle.
I mean, it was definitely affecting her sleep. It was affecting her waking life. She got a fast-forward version of the kind of toll that it took on these detectives over the span of decades, you know, in the space of a couple of years. So it was pretty intense.
And she was starting to see how her obsession, the detective's obsession, in some ways matched the killer's obsession.
Well, yeah, she has a line in her book where she's like, the same drive that's pulling us to capture him is very similar fuel to what's making him go out and commit these disgusting crimes. So, you know, there's that moment of realization that, you know, it's hard to look at, but it's true.
Well, and you told us about a time these detectives are going out to these neighborhoods, they're going to these homes, mm-hmm. and in some cases they're wandering around the yards just the way he did. And they showed her, how you could look in windows.
Well, how easy it was, especially for these, single-level homes, to just look in these windows. It's almost like a menagerie. They can't see out, and you're looking in, and it's a strange kind of, she sort of gets into that head of, this is what he must have been seeing, and it's very disturbing.
It's disturbing too, because she kind of likes it. This idea that you could look in and no one would know.
Well, she can see how it would become addictive.
Yeah. And troubling. Look, she is so, her work is amazing. She tracks down a set of cufflinks that for a nanosecond everybody thinks might have been stolen from one of the victims. And therefore, if it was at a pawn shop, maybe they could track the killer that way. It turns out to be a false lead.
Oh, yeah. She went to so many weird twists and turns following down just a possible lead and wherever, does it lead to some kind of link? You can't control what leads you'll be given, what clues you'll be given, and where they'll take you. So, yeah, she did that a lot and hit a lot of walls.
Well, and almost hit you.
Yeah, it was that crazy, she had been asleep, and I think the case was still in her head. And so when I came in, she, kind of woke up screaming and almost threw a lamp at me, because she was reliving home invasions in her head and looking at them through the point of view of the people that had been invaded and had been attacked.
Yeah. She's a beautiful writer, and the one of the most glorious lines, there's a scream permanently lodged in my throat now.
Yeah, that's one of many amazing lines in that book.
Yeah. But what's so uncanny is that she wrote a letter to him. It's in case she dies and warning of the online community that will pick up her work.
Yeah, exactly. There's more electronic windows opening up around you than windows you ever peeped in. And I'm just trying to open as many of those as I can.
It's almost as if she knew. She somehow knew. She wrote, I'm leaving boxes of stuff. Even if I'm gone, somebody's going to use my stuff. And then she was gone, way too young, way too soon.
It's still a fresh wound for me at least, so.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Although, you've remarried and you're determined to live in the light, which this killer is not.
Right. That's the deepest rebuke you can give to an insect like this, is to try to live in the light as much as you can.
Yeah. Patton Oswalt, the book that he helped bring to completion, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, One Woman's Obsessive Search for the Golden State Killer, written by his wife, Michelle McNamara. Patton, we appreciate you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Our conversation with Patton Oswalt in 2018. I'll Be Gone in the Dark is now a 6-part documentary series on HBO. You're listening to Here and Now. Contact tracing across the U.S. has had mixed and mostly lackluster results, but in San Francisco, where COVID-19 case numbers have been lower than the rest of the state, early tracing efforts have been pretty successful, and that may be in part because of the city's focus on recruiting contact tracers who can speak to affected communities in their native languages. KQED's April Domboski reports.
Time Eric Chan started training to become a contact tracer, he started watching the news in Chinese. He wanted to brush up on his Cantonese, especially medical terms.
Quite often, just speaking that language directly instead of having the interpreter on the line, it helps a lot with the communication and the trust.
Early on, Chan noticed the potential for things to get lost in translation. In Cantonese, the words for quarantine and isolation are the same word.
It's called gatle. It's kind of mean just separating from others.
Quarantine is for people who've been in contact with someone who's sick and have to stay home. Isolation is when you know you're sick and have to isolate yourself in a room separate from your family. Normally, Chan works as a financial analyst in the tax assessor's office. He's very detail-oriented. So he decided every time he translated each word, he would give the definition too.
And also the duration of the quarantine isolation are different. So that's why we want to get it as specific as possible.
Half the people who have died from COVID-19 in San Francisco are Asian American. And in California, like almost every other state, Latinos account for more infections than their share of the population. John Jacobo with the Latino Task Force in San Francisco says having contact tracers from the communities that are most affected by the virus is critical for getting accurate information about how it's spreading.
We have to have culturally competent contact tracers that understand the cultural customs and the language.
For example, he says, take the common polite response among Latinos when you ask, how are you? Do you need anything?
And the first answer is always, oh, no, I'm good. I don't need anything. But if you pry a little more, you get the real answer, which is, you know, actually, maybe.
En la lucha contra el COVID-19,
the state is running PSAs like these to encourage Latinos to first pick up the phone when contact tracers call.
Porque si tu prueba es positiva, tendrás acceso a...
If you test positive, you'll have access to medical treatment regardless of your income or immigration status.
O de tu estatus migratorio.
I speak Spanish, so most of the calls that I do make are to those who only speak Spanish.
Some of the folks contact tracer Jasmine Flores has talked to have been worried about revealing their immigration status. Some questions make them nervous.
You know, who's living with you? Where do you live? Some people might not want to share all of that information.
She assures them that nothing goes beyond the health department.
You just let them know that this is all confidential. It's just to help you and to help others and to help try to resolve the situation, stop it from getting worse.
So far, San Francisco contact tracers have reached 9 out of 10 people they try to call. And program leaders say the overwhelming sentiment is that they're receptive.
I'm actually quite surprised at how open they can be and how they actually kind of feel like chatting, I feel like. We're just chatting about them and how they're doing and their family.
The bottom line is, if people don't want to share personal information, they don't have to. Contact tracers will tell them where they can find information about the virus or get tested on their own. For Here and Now, I'm April Dymbosky.
President Trump kicks off 4th of July celebrations with a visit Friday to Mount Rushmore in South Dakota. There will be fireworks over the sculptures of Presidents Washington, Jefferson, Roosevelt, and Lincoln for the first time in a decade, despite concerns that the surrounding forest will catch on fire. The mountain makes for a dramatic backdrop for presidents. Here's what President Roosevelt said about the monument at its unveiling ceremony in 1936.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt, that they will believe that we have honestly striven in our day and generation to preserve for our descendants a decent land to live in and a decent form of government to operate under.
Well, many Native Americans see it quite differently, and Trump's visit also comes during a national debate over the future of Confederate statues and monuments. Turns out this controversy also applies to Mount Rushmore because of the man who sculpted it. John Tolliver is author of Great White Fathers, The True Story of Gutzon Borglum and His Obsessive Quest to Create Mount Rushmore National Monument. John, welcome.
Delighted.
So Borglum created these 60-foot-high sculptures of the U.S. presidents between 1927 and 1941, but how did the idea of putting their faces on that mountain come about in the first place?
Well, Mount Rushmore is also called the Shrine of Democracy. Borglum conceived it as a great national monument. He had come up with the idea of building a Confederate monument on Stone Mountain, Georgia, with Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis, and Stonewall Jackson. He'd gotten crosswise with the folks there, including the Ku Klux Klan, who he was very cozy with. And he was given this opportunity to go out to South Dakota in the mid-20s to do something. They didn't tell him exactly what to do. And instead of doing a regional monument, which a Confederate monument would have been, he thought it would be a national memorial. And so he thought up the idea of putting these four presidents on there. As a reminder, as FDR said, that thousands of years from now, there was a great civilization on this continent.
Well, and many people might disagree with that, including Native Americans, who say that the sculpture, the mountain, is a desecration of sacred lands. Was it controversial from the start, or, you know, was anyone listening to the Lakota Sioux who long say the land's been stolen from them?
Not so much. It took a while for the Sioux to really realize what was going on, but it is indeed sacred. Mount Rushmore, I am not Native American, but to Native Americans, Mount Rushmore isn't a poke in the eye, it's a poke in the heart. Hmm. This land that Mount Rushmore is on was given to the Sioux by the U.S. Congress in 1868, permanent ownership, and then taken away from them. So they have a legitimate beef. Rushmore is like the Statue of Liberty was meant to be sort of shorthand for what America is, but it's not. It's more complicated than that.
And how did the Sioux view the men who are carved into the mountain? How do they see them today?
Well, they're white patriarchs. When I was researching my book, I went and visited various tribal people, Cheyenne, River Sioux, and Pine Ridge, and they were making comparisons to Nazis.
Hmm. Well, there's another reason that this monument is so noteworthy in this time, and you've already said why, and it's that the sculptor, Goodson Borglum, had ties to the KKK and was also responsible for the Confederate monument in Georgia's Stone Mountain. Tell me more about him.
He was very coy about his Klan connections. He would claim that he wasn't a member, but like our president today, he did not hesitate to say, there are some good people in the Klan. He was on Klan councils. He met with them. He had lots of friends with him. He was cozy, to say the least, with the Klan.
Mm. You know, I didn't know this. I've been to the monument. I've spent hours there reading about it.
I don't want you to know it. Mount Rushmore and the National Park Service do not express this side of the story. It doesn't work into their narrative, which was a group of hardworking artisans who were determined and tough and polyglot, building this great memorial to our American civilization. The idea that the sculptor had basically cut his teeth on a Confederate monument sponsored by the Klan just doesn't fit into the narrative.
So what should we do as American people with that information? Because as you say, this mountain is known as a shrine to democracy. The men who are depicted on it, many people believe, are wonderful presidents who are the founders of this country. And on the other hand, it's a deep source of pain for Native Americans. And it was made by a man who very likely was racist. What do we do with all this information?
Well, Mount Rushmore is like a Rorschach. It says different things to different people, and not all of those things are good. I'm not one to say that Mount Rushmore should continue to exist. I think it would be hard to take it down unless you get the Taliban to do what they did to Buddhist monuments. And so until it's there, I think we use it as a teaching opportunity. Let's not cover up this past. Let's say these are the gnarly, complex elements of America. Mount Rushmore was created at a time when there was a certain consensus that we had heroes, that we had common heroes in this country. That doesn't exist anymore. It's all, everybody's got flaws, and it's warts and all the warts are evident. The thing we need to remember about Mount Rushmore, when you look at it, it's incomplete. It was meant to be not just the 60-foot faces, but go all the way to the waist. And we ran out of money. World War II came along, and democracy was something Americans were very concerned about at the time, but it couldn't be finished. As a metaphor for America, it's kind of low-hanging fruit. You know, we're not perfect, and Mount Rushmore tells us that.
Hmm. Well, last week, the president of the Oglala Sioux, Julian Bear Runner, said that Mount Rushmore should be removed. In response to the recent controversy, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, who's a Republican, said not on her watch. Let's listen.
This is a national monument. The more we focus on the flaws of these men that are on our mountain, the less likely we are to recognize the virtues.
Now, this is not a statue in a city park that can be taken down with a rope. And President Trump is on his way there this week to celebrate the 4th of July. Do you think that's a constructive thing to do in this time of national pain?
Well, President Trump wants, like other presidents who have been to Mount Rushmore, it's a great backdrop. It makes them look magisterial. It's a way of them saying, hey, I'm like one of these great men up there, too. Trump has, of course, always been obsessed with size. The idea that he would go down in history as, you know, the fifth head on Mount Rushmore, I'm sure would appeal to him. He'll fly in, stand up in front of it. The fireworks will go off and he'll go home. And Mount Rushmore will still be there for us to appreciate or to despise. I would not predict Mount Rushmore is going to tumble anytime soon.
John Tolliver is author of Great White Fathers, The True Story of Gutzon Borglum and His Obsessive Quest to Create the Mount Rushmore National Monument. Timely as ever, John. Thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
As courts across the country move to safely reopen, many will require face masks. So how will it impact a trial if a witness's face is covered? This is something Julia Simon Kerr has been thinking about. She's professor of law at the UConn School of Law. Her essay on masks will be published in Arguendo, part of the George Washington Law Review. And Professor, you write that face masks have benefits beyond public health because justice may be better served when we don't see a witness's full face. And that's contrary to what we might think. You know, we think we can see truth in someone's face. So what do you mean it's better to cover?
Yeah, I know it's pretty counterintuitive. We have a strong cultural assumption that we can learn something about a person's truthfulness if we look at their face. But the reality is that there is no evidence to support that assumption. In fact, some studies have shown that we're worse at telling if somebody is truthful when we are focusing on their face, trying to read facial cues.
Well, two things. First of all, this reminds us of conversations we've had about orchestra auditions, because there was a realization that bias played a role. So they started some having auditions behind a screen. So you couldn't attach anything you thought about somebody's gender or their color or their looks or their face to what you're actually hearing, their sound. Same here. You're saying you want to hear what someone says. But tell us more. I mean, why else would we be thrown by what you call their demeanor, their face?
Yeah, so the orchestra analogy is great, and it's a very similar thing. We're thrown because the face tells us things about a person. It tells us their gender often. It often tells us their race or leads to assumptions about their race. It can also tell us things about their level of social privilege. And all of those things can influence how we think about whether we will default to believing someone. So it's not about their words and whether their words are credible and make sense to us, but rather what kind of person we think they are. Hmm.
Well, but you're still going to know someone is black or female if they have a face mask on.
Yes, that's right. So the face mask isn't going to be the total solution, like auditioning for an orchestra behind a screen. But my feeling is that it will still help us move away from this assumption, which is really prevalent in a lot of legal doctrines, that we have to see the whole face of the witness, that the face is the most expressive part of the body, and it's very important to look at it when we're making credibility judgments. So I think if we're covering up half of the face, that gets us some way to disengaging from that belief and questioning it.
It goes a little more towards justice being blind, you know, that you want to hear, you know, but not see. But on the other hand, we are told that people get to face their accusers. Is there some problem there that someone doesn't really get to see who's the witness against them?
Yeah, that's right. We do have the Confrontation Clause in the U.S. Constitution, which says that, you know, we have the right to confront witnesses against us. Of course, that's only for criminal defendants. But this does pose a problem for that doctrine. I think it can be overcome legally because we have an important governmental interest in controlling the pandemic right now. And I think ultimately what the Confrontation Clause cares about is that you can't be convicted of something just on the basis of a statement someone made who won't come in and say that statement in your presence. So in my opinion, we could still accomplish that with face masks and even with more serious measures like a screen, although that's a bit more of a radical idea.
So, Professor, you think that face masks will be a good thing ultimately in court because they might help eliminate these false assumptions we have that we can read people's face? You say the research shows that we actually can't. But I'm wondering if this might be a negative, in particular for Black Americans and Black men. We had a young Black man on the program who was worried about wearing a face mask because he felt it would cast him in a negative, stereotypical light. He'd look like a burglar. Might this be a negative for Black men in court?
Yeah, that's a really important question. And it is possible that masks might have the opposite effect of the one that I would hope they might have. I have some hope that this might not be the case, although I think it would depend on a great deal of care being taken in the courtroom. For example, issuing everyone in the courtroom the same type of mask, I think, could help mitigate that problem. I also think this might depend where we are in the country. If we're in a part of the country where masks have been required in public for a long time and people have gotten used to it and people are complying, then I think seeing everyone in masks in the courtroom has less risk of reinforcing stereotypes. On the other hand, if we're in a place where people have not been wearing masks, there's little compliance, even if there is a mask mandate, then I do think the risk of stereotyping is something we have to take very seriously.
Julia Simon Kerr, professor of law at the UConn School of Law, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.